Liberation Radio.
Capitalism needs poverty.
A world run by a handful of greedy bankers and CEOs who nobody elected can't possibly last.
Whatever we could do, we're gonna do, especially in continuing to preserve this earth.
Each week, we bring you interviews, commentary, analysis, political developments, and struggles affecting workers throughout the country as a way to build the movement for socialism in the United States.
The revolution will be broadcast.
The only thing that will ever defeat racism will be the defeat of its parents, capitalism and imperialism.
Without smashing mass incarceration, working people of all nationalities cannot have justice.
Liberation Radio is brought to you by the Party for Socialism and Liberation.
Welcome to this week's edition of Liberation Radio, a podcast of the Party for Socialism and Liberation. I'm your host, Marcel Cartier. This week we speak to Eugene Perrier, the vice presidential candidate of the Party for Socialism and Liberation, ahead of the New Hampshire primaries. Eugene analyzes the results of the Iowa caucuses, as well as the surge of support for Bernie Sanders. What does it all mean, and why is the PSL intervening in the 2016 elections? And we'll be speaking to Hafsa Kara Mustafa, who recently appeared on the show Loud and Clear with Brian Becker. We'll be playing a portion of the interview with Brian Becker from Loud and Clear about what Libya is going through 5 years after the NATO bombing campaign. But first, we turn to Eugene Perrier and the 2016 elections. Tomorrow we'll see the New Hampshire primaries take place, coming just over a week after the Iowa caucuses that stunned the country. After previously being down by 40 points in the polls, Bernie Sanders charged ahead to finish in a dead heat with Hillary Clinton. On the Republican side, the upset was the victory of Ted Cruz over Donald Trump. Ahead of New Hampshire, Sanders has a double-digit lead over Clinton, while Trump is expected to win on the Republican side. What do the 2016 elections represent? To help us understand it all, we are joined by Eugene Perrier. He is the vice presidential candidate for the Party for Socialism and Liberation in the 2016 presidential elections. Welcome, Eugene.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So, Eugene, I wanted to start off with the question of the shock dead heat in Iowa. I mean, just how big of a surprise was the fact that Bernie Sanders, you know, down by 40 points in Iowa, was able to charge ahead and actually virtually tie Hillary Clinton? And also, what would a victory for Sanders in New Hampshire represent? Is the Democratic establishment running scared?
Well, I think the Democratic establishment is definitely running scared. I don't think they expected this. I don't think anyone really expected this. I mean, there's some people in the Clinton camp trying to refer to Senator Sanders as someone who, you know, was sort of an also-ran in the Senate and in the Congress, didn't do that much. Now, I think that's a little unfair, but either way, he was a fairly minor figure inside of the Congress, unless you were a progressive person when he was more of a champion for those causes. But that being said, to come out of nowhere, someone who calls himself a socialist in the most anti-communist country, someone who's not raising money from all the rich people, and against Hillary Clinton, who, whatever her other faults and foibles, is certainly very popular amongst Democrats, and knowing how Democrats were feeling, started her campaign a little more to the left before Senator Sanders ever even got in, to speak to what she felt the desire of candidates were, maybe and perhaps almost certainly cynically and manipulatively, but nevertheless, she seemed to be the right kind of candidate with the right kind of money and a message that was at least palpable enough that she should pretty easily win. But Sanders, I think, has revealed a major fault line. I think a win by Sanders, especially a significant one in New Hampshire, will reveal that a little more, that the reality is that of the tens of millions of people who vote in the Democratic primary, many of them are anxious for a fight back against policies of austerity, racism, anti-LGBTQ bigotry, whatever you want to name it. Certainly Wall Street as the center focal point of people's hatred over the inequality and other things that exist in this country, obviously is motivating many, 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 many people, new people. If you look at the Iowa caucuses, you know, all the new people, the vast majority of new people were voting for Sanders. 84% of young people were voting for Sanders. So, you know, sort of the demographics that favor change heavily are really flocking to Sanders' banner because they think he can succeed.
So, I mean, you may have answered already some of this in your last response, but what do you think the Sanders campaign actually represents politically? Now, he calls himself a democratic socialist, obviously. And as you pointed out, someone who, you know, proclaims himself to be a socialist in a country that, you know, really has as its unofficial religion, anti-communism, anti-socialism, is truly astounding. But what does the increased interest in socialism mean for this coming political period, and what really accounts for this?
I think it means that people know capitalism isn't working, and they see it every day, and they're wondering what are the potential alternatives that could exist. And socialism, whatever its history, which is very vast and diverse and diffuse, is something different. And I think people want to hear more about it. Some people are already exploring it and trying to learn more about it, but that people are looking for an alternative. I mean, Sanders' program is essentially FDR, LBJ style liberalism, you know, social spending on these sorts of different things, education, healthcare, so on and so forth, infrastructure building, providing jobs through government programs, and, you know, a foreign policy that is still highly imperialist. So, I mean, it's not actually outside of the traditional liberal consensus in post-war America, or I guess slightly pre-war with FDR, the New Deal consensus, if you will. But it's outside of the fact that the New Deal consensus has been rolled back, really starting with Reagan in American politics, and the whole register of American politics have moved to the right. So his politics actually don't match up with his language about being a socialist. I think if he was to go to Europe, where there are many socialists and communists of different sorts in parliaments, you know, he would actually be not considered that socialistic by what he's proposing. But that being said, just the fact that he's saying it is opening up a lot in such an anti-communist country. And the fact that what he represents is a type of liberalism that was banished from bourgeois politics, not because it's anti-capitalist, but because it's anti-neoliberal. And the capitalists who are attempting to restore the profit rates they were losing in the crisis of the 1970 have moved to a neoliberal austerity race to the bottom economy, and they are not willing to move back, which is why you see the establishment striking hard at Bernie Sanders. So for the establishment, that's what he means. Not anti-capitalism, but a rolling back of the assault they've put on working people and oppressed people that has, you know, made them very rich. And for the masses of people, he represents sort of the path of least resistance fight back. Tired of this Wall Street-driven 1% inequality, vote for Bernie Sanders, right? He represents that first ability and a path of least resistance type ability for people to go out and actually feel like they're fighting back against these conditions that are pushing down on them so heavily, which I think is a heartening sign that people do want to do something in large numbers against these sorts of terrible inequalities and inequities put forward by capitalism.
Well, I want to talk about the Republican primary as well. I mean, we've spoken before on Liberation Radio about what the Trump phenomenon represents, where it came from. But Ted Cruz actually won the Iowa caucuses on the Republican end. I mean, he's also a figure who you could consider to be part of the ultra right. I mean, how is it that the Republican Party has moved so far to what seems like ultra right positions, where talk of, you know, xenophobia, anti-immigrant bashing, anti-Latino rhetoric, anti-Muslim bigotry is just so prevalent and it seems so mainstream in the Republican narrative now?
Well, as the old saying goes, the Republicans were hoisted on their own petard. I mean, they really wanted this Citizens United because they thought if they just let unlimited corporate cash flow into the race, it could only be good for, you know, them. I mean, certainly many corporate Democrats, but certainly Republicans. But the opposite has happened. It's completely backfired because now any one billionaire, a tiny group of billionaires, can fund a viable presidential candidacy for their pet candidate. And I think that what you're seeing at the end of the day is this, is that you have a hardcore cabal of right-wing ruling class people who don't want to take one step back in the war they've been waging on working and oppressed people around this world called austerity, by a lot of different people. And they have put forward and funded this Tea Party rebellion and this ultra-right, far-right movement and tried to form organizations and incubate it to try to prevent any social progress from happening in this country. And it makes sense that when you're pushing a conservative economic program, that it has the most relevance when it's couched in sort of a broader, you know, this sort of free market fundamentalism that can't give progress to anyone. So it's an anti-progressive economic policy will fit within sort of an anti-progressive social policy. I mean, the two things, it's a little more complicated than that, but it makes sense that you put it in this whole milieu where you try to capitalize on the demise, not the demise, but the erosion of white privilege in the large sections of the white middle class. And you appeal to people like, well, remember when America had a good economy in the 50s? It seemed like blacks weren't doing well, gays weren't doing well, women were in the home, whatever. And now that things are bad for you and your sort of traditional white privilege, suburban, whatever, factory job type family, that it must be these other people's fault. They must be gaining at your expense. And that's exactly what we're talking about as Republicans. These people are gaining at your expense. We need to go back to our quote-unquote values. And then one of our quote-unquote values, of course, is obviously the quote-unquote free market, although that's a little misnomer in and of itself. And it all fits together in one pretty neat, although kind of witch's brew style package. And the people who are channeling that the best, all this hatred and xenophobia, along with this free market fundamentalism, are the ones who seem to be succeeding the most.
Well, Eugene, what about the intervention of third parties in the race? I mean, you're the vice presidential candidate for the Party for Socialism and Liberation, the PSL. Why are you running? Why is it important? And what do you hope to accomplish by doing so?
Well, I think there's a lot of points. I mean, I think that, you know, first and foremost, there are people who want to fight and look to the elections for people who reflect their political views. And why should anyone be forced to only choose the views that are put in front of them? I mean, we believe that we have a program, the 10-point program at votepsl.org, that can really solve the problems of everyday working people, or at least get on the road to solving those problems. And that if we're talking about, you know, capitalism and socialism, we can't just throw around the terms. We have to be realistic that capitalism is a system that has to be removed, and that's a major, major process. And we want to really get in those conversations and talk to people and get into the areas where they're paying attention to, people who care about politics and change, and really give them an opportunity to look at what really can be done and to find people who agree with them. I think there's an unprecedented nature of interest in socialism right now that people are going to, and already have shown that they're really hungry for this. And I think it's a very important to not leave. I mean, if you look at, we're mentioning austerity, they're everywhere. They're pushing it in the elections. They're pushing it on TV. They're doing it in your everyday life, of course, because it's affecting you. I mean, it's a full spectrum attack on the rights of working people, on the rights of women, on the rights of LGBTQ people. It's a full spectrum attack in the courts, in the elections, in the legislative sphere, in the media, in the streets. And so if we're not fighting back against these things in every single sphere, then we're behind the eight ball right now. We're allowing those who we say are doing negative things to working class people, to everyday working and poor people, that we're just going to give up in one arena and unilaterally disarm. But the reality is the elections are a major part of how the political conversation is shaped in this country. And even though the election laws don't favor third parties and really make it impossible for them to succeed by making the system rigged towards billionaires and multimillionaires and people whose friends are billionaires and multimillionaires, that we have to be able to get in there and fight to get in wherever we can with a real message that can meet the scale of people's problems. Because at the end of the day, the two major parties, whatever they're proposing, it is not going to solve the scale of the problems that exist for working class and poor people. And when you get to those that scale, that's when you're challenging the capitalist system. That's when you become inaccessible in the political sphere. And we have to be able to push real solutions to real people if we're going to move this country forward in any way, in the world, quite frankly, because we can't be just Americans. We have to be citizens of the world. Humanity has to live together sustainably, you know, as a unified human organism. We're all already connected through the global labor and supply chain, so we need to actualize that in how we live in a sustainable, equitable way for all people.
Well, Eugene, any final words to our listeners, and how can people find out about your presidential campaign, and how can they get involved in the streets?
Well, that would be my only final thoughts. VotePSL.org, VotePSL.org, VotePSL.org. Go on VotePSL.org and check us out.
And now we turn to an exclusive interview from Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, the show that is broadcast 5 days a week on Radio Sputnik in more than 60 countries. It's also on SputnikNews.com. Be sure to follow the Facebook page for the show. You can log on to Facebook and search for Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, or alternatively find it at Facebook.com/LoudandClearBrianBecker.
How is it that it's not Iraq, it's not Syria, that the United States and the 22 other countries are focusing now, but on Libya? And how is it that Libya ended up with ISIS coming to play such an important political role and a military role in Libya?
Well, because ISIS, the U.S. already created the environment for ISIS to thrive in Iraq in the aftermath of its invasion in 2003. Therefore, it was Libya's turn to enjoy the consequences of a U.S.-led military intervention, which obviously is in Libya, and that's where ISIS is now spreading and now developing greatly. Now, one of the reasons ISIS is in Libya is precisely because of the NATO onslaught of 2011, which led to a power vacuum in which terrorist organizations such as ISIS actually thrive. It was hugely predictable that this would happen, given the Iraqi scenario of 10 years before. But what was also predictable was for these organizations to develop because Muammar Gaddafi was such a barrier to these fanatic elements, which had been trying to enter Libya for many, many years, and which couldn't, thanks to Gaddafi's very serious and very efficient policies in actually stopping their expansion, both in Libya and also around the region across the Sahel belt.
Hillary Clinton, then Secretary of State, said on October 20th, 2011, the day that Gaddafi was killed, executed, assassinated, sodomized, "We came, we saw, he died," and she was laughing. That's a very famous little clip on video now. Here she is running for the Democratic Party nomination, getting the enthusiastic endorsement, as they put it, from the New York Times and the Washington Post, centers of the Democratic Party establishment. And at the same time, the U.S. has to gather together 22 other countries in Rome to concentrate in the fight against ISIL's rise in Libya. I mean, talk about Hillary Clinton's role in the destruction of Libya, if you would.
Well, Hillary was central to getting a coalition to actually coming to Libya and force the ouster of Gaddafi. She was the flag bearer, if you will, of the NATO operation. I mean, it was spearheaded by the French, but Hillary Clinton was very much in favor of it, and she applauded it, and she supported it, and she sort of sold it to the U.S. public, which at the time was slightly reluctant. As you recall, there was, you know, hesitation in light precisely of the Iraqi catastrophe. And so therefore, she sold basically the Libya catastrophe. So she is very central to the ouster of Gaddafi and the consequent chaos that ensued. She's also central to what later happened in Benghazi. And it's utterly shameful that the person currently running for the highest office in the U.S. is someone who gleefully celebrated the lynching and the extrajudicial assassination of a 70-year-old man. You know, regardless of where anyone stands on Gaddafi, I think it's fair to say that if we are to advocate law and order, at the very least, we can expect due process and a legal process by which people will be made accountable for their actions. And lynching and violated the way he was, and then his remains exposed and spat on and, you know, photographed for a week in the most depraved manner, was very, very disturbing. And I think the way that she celebrated that is just as disturbing as the event itself, and I think is sadly says a lot about the image of the U.S. today outside. It's a country that celebrates death, celebrates destruction, and actually has no remorse about what it does and the consequences of its actions.
And what about the strategy of the United States? If you would, I mean, okay, the United States decided that they could take out Gaddafi under the pretext of protecting civilians. They got the UN Security Council with the support of Russia and China at the time, or at least their abstention on Resolution 1973, which meant that there could be the authorization, of course, to protect civilians. And at the same time, it's quite clear now from Clinton's email, some of those that are have been released as a result of the State Department being forced to by a Freedom of Information Act request, that some of these emails even were on her private server, that the United States had a clear calculating policy to destroy the Libyan government. It wasn't really about protecting civilians. But what was the strategy, or what was the goal of the strategy?
I think the situation we're seeing today is very much part of the strategy. First of all, let's go back to 1973 and remind the listeners that actually it was initially simply imposing a no-fly zone. That was the resolution. So it basically would have stopped any airplane carriers to fly above Benghazi. From the first day, from day one, it actually violated the very terms of the resolutions because it started pounding Tripoli. And many people will have forgotten that on that very day it started, Jacob Zuma was flying in from Johannesburg in a bid to try and broker peace talks between the opposing parties and eventually help to find a peaceful resolution to the burgeoning conflict. At no point was any chance given to stop the fighting between the various parties and actually find a peaceful resolution to the emerging conflict. So it was never about protecting the people, because when you are attempting to protect a civilian population, A, you avoid conflict at all costs, and once it starts, at the very least, you attempt and you encourage a peaceful resolution to the burgeoning conflict. That was never attempted. What was attempted, and if you'll remember, the first protest started on the 15th of February. By the 24th of March, Operation Unified Protector started, which means that within a few weeks, the entire international community, and by international community, I obviously mean Western powers, had already agreed upon the pounding operation and the onslaught on Libya, whose consequences we're seeing today. So there was never any attempt to, A, protect civilians. And of course, it never did, because what people never say is that as many as 30,000 Libyans actually lost their lives as a result of the bombing campaign, which lasted for 6 months and in which we saw the utter destruction of the western coast of Libya.
What was the objective? Was there an objective? Did Hillary Clinton, was she motivated by just imperial hubris, the arrogance of power, drunk with power, the ability to do what could be done to take down a government that had been a long time thorn in the side and at other times been targeted by the U.S., certainly by Ronald Reagan for bombing in 1986? Or was there some goal in mind for Libya in terms of U.S. geopolitical concerns in North Africa?
Well, whichever way you look at it, the end game was never to benefit the Libyans or Libya or the wider African continent. The end game was always designed to benefit US interests, and that was primarily the goal, regardless of how many people died, the level of destruction and the ensuing chaos. Now, you'd have to remember that Gaddafi was fiercely independent. He worked tirelessly to help Africa actually slowly but gradually rid itself of imperialist stronghold against African economies. And to do that, he used the wealth coming generated from the oil revenue to help several African countries. And that obviously was unhelpful to US and Western interests in general. I mean, when you think about it, Africa is the wealthiest continent on the planet. And without African natural resources, almost all of Western industries couldn't function. And therefore, when a continent is completely destabilized and weakened, the terms of the purchasing terms that African nations have with Western counterparts are done exclusively on Western terms. Now, if you have stable countries, therefore they will start selling their natural resources at market rate prices. But of course, in a disabled, completely destroyed, ravaged country, the natural resources are really sold willy-nilly anywhere to the first opportunity, you know, to any buyer. And they're usually, these sales are done at the buyer's term. So a destroyed Libya, which is incredibly oil and gas rich, which has potential, you know, very close to European borders, open to the Sahel region, which is rich in uranium, is actually a much, much better force for Western corporations to exploit the country and region rather than a strong, stable Libya, which would have sold its resources at the market prices and which would not have agreed to any terms. So the end game was this catastrophe and this strategy, regardless of the human, the cost to human lives and to infrastructure, as long as it serves American interests, that's the main thing. And this this destruction is part of the end game.
Yes, and we know from some of the released WikiLeaks cables, they were State Department cables, that the State Department had, even although Gaddafi had changed his economic policy, gotten rid of some of the weapon systems, tried to have a general rapprochement or detente or accommodation with Western powers, that there was still great anger against Gaddafi's government, which they considered to be resource nationalists, as they put it, meaning, as you said, that Gaddafi and the Libyan government were attempting to negotiate prices in a way that was beneficial to Libya or beneficial to the people of Libya, or not the cheapest price that the Western governments could or Western corporations could extract from other producing countries. I want to ask you about Sirte itself, the city where ISIL seems to have the greatest leverage, the greatest power at the moment. That was a Gaddafi stronghold. It would be after Tripoli fell as the capital, after the NATO bombing that started in March, end of March 2011, and Tripoli finally was captured by opposition forces in August, Gaddafi moved the capital of Libya to Sirte. And now it's under the control of ISIL. How did that come to be, and who is ISIL in Sirte?
Well, you have to remember that what NATO did, it did with accordance and in complicity with the Islamist extremists that had always targeted Gaddafi. And one of these accomplices was Hakim Belhaj, who was a sworn enemy of Gaddafi and who immediately took up arms with the help of NATO against the Gaddafi's rule. Once his ouster happened, he therefore formed coalitions along with organizations such as Al-Qaeda and everything in order to expand and bring in the ideology, which is the same ideology as ISIS, inside Libya. And I think what better way to do it than to settle precisely within Sirte, which was a Gaddafi stronghold and which indicated that the new boss in town would be the Belhaj and the Nusras and the Al-Qaeda and everything. In other words, this is clearly indicating that the Green Libya is dead and that the new guys in charge, with the help of NATO, has to be said, are the Islamists.
This is Liberation Radio. The PSL is a different kind of political party. We are not a party of career politicians, but a working class party of activists and organizers, fighting for a system where the wealth of society belongs not to a tiny, privileged elite of multi-billionaires, but the workers who produce it. Visit pslweb.org to learn more about the PSL, find a branch near you, and learn how you can become a member. Again, that's pslweb.org, pslweb.org.